That's CAPITALBOP.com.
I'm Weezy Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Now, people who can believe that I was happy on the levee picking cotton, or happy in the mines digging coal, and giving all this away to other people for their wealth, and unable to protect my house, my woman, my children, are people who can believe that I did this out of love for other people, and that I was happy doing it, and that all those songs and dances I learned while I was doing it meant that I was happy, can believe anything.
That's the unmistakable voice of the great James Baldwin. This week on From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio, we look at the political life of this remarkable man. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. James Baldwin was known to the world as the genius behind the literary works Go Tell It on the Mountain, Notes of a Native Son, Giovanni's Room, and The Fire Next Time, among others. His work, whether fiction or nonfiction, brought the realities of life for African Americans in this country to worldwide attention. His responsibility was to be, as he so often prefaced his words at speeches, brutally honest. That honesty made him a leader in the fight for civil rights. His voice was as mesmerizing as Martin's, his ideas as revolutionary as Malcolm's, and yet he fits somewhere in the middle of the two. We are lucky enough here at the Pacifica Radio Archives to have a generous collection of speeches given by him and interviews done with him. This week on From the Vault, we're concentrating on his political life. I'm not going to fill the time with tons of biographical information. I'll give you the main points, but what I want to do most is let Baldwin speak for Baldwin. Included in this week's program is audio from the early 1960s to the late 1960s. Basically, the period of time when Baldwin went from being a great influential writer to the forefront of the civil rights movement.
Now, I have to say some very reckless things tonight, and so I want to make it absolutely clear that I am talking for myself. I am not, I might be at other platforms and other occasions, more or less representing this or that organization or this or that committee. But tonight, I am talking to you as Jimmy Baldwin, who was born in Harlem 39 years ago, who has a certain responsibility to the people that produced him, that is all of you. And I'm speaking to you, if I may say so, not as an organizer, and not as a Negro leader, and not as a public figure, not as any of those things, but as one of the poets that you produced.
James Baldwin was born in Harlem, New York in 1924, the oldest child of a large family. He never knew his real father, but his mother married a factory worker and storefront preacher whose name Baldwin took. Baldwin once wrote of his father, "As I grew older, he looked like pictures I had seen of African chieftains. He really should have been naked with war paint on and barbaric mementos standing among spears. He could be chilling in the pulpit and indescribably cruel in his personal life, and he was certainly the most bitter man I had ever met." Baldwin grew up extremely poor, but learned to appreciate his family situation later in life.
I come from a very poor family, and there's a vast amount of vitality, which is a very definite virtue, to be found in those circumstances.
By the time James Baldwin became fully immersed in the civil rights struggle, he had written what are considered his great works. It has been said by many that his involvement in the civil rights movement drained him of his imaginative energy. If this is so, then we can muse over what we didn't receive from his creative mind, while comforting ourselves that this country received in return his actions. Here he speaks at Oakland's Castlemont High School in June 1963.
I think the other reason, and perhaps the most important reason, that I'm throwing the suggestions out to you tonight is that in this country, every black man born in this country until this present moment is born into a country which assures him in as many ways as it can find that he is not worth the dirt he walks on. Every Negro boy and every Negro girl born in this country until this present moment undergoes the agony of trying to find in the body politic, in the body social, outside himself, herself, some image of himself or herself which is not demeaning. Now many, indeed, have survived, and at an incalculable cost. And many more have perished and are perishing every day. If you tell a child and do your best to prove to the child that he is not worth life, it is entirely possible that sooner or later the child begins to believe it.
Baldwin was very outspoken as well about the politicians and the structure in Washington.
There is, my friends, really, a point at which one has to say, I will not choose between the lesser of two evils. There is no such thing as a lesser of two evils. If the political machines in Washington and elsewhere in the nation cannot throw up better material than Mr. Goldwater, Mr. Nixon, Mr. Kennedy, and so on down an extremely dreary line, then perhaps we, the people, whom these dreary people are supposed to represent, ought to find a way of being represented. There are some things that I want to talk about, to suggest to you, and that I want to find out what you think, and perhaps we can establish a dialogue, and if we are extremely disciplined and hard-headed, passionate and moral, we might be able even to rock that rock which is called Washington.
My city's bracing for the next killing thing, standing by the bridge and praying for the next Dr. Martin Luther.
I didn't know I was going to talk, really, you know, and I'm not going to talk very long.
Here, Baldwin introduces Dr. Martin Luther King at an event in Los Angeles in 1968 and proceeds to speak off the cuff with no prepared remarks.
The man who we are here to talk to, who will talk to us, that is Martin Luther King. I think it's very important to remember that this moment in 1968 is a kind of combination of things that began in this country quite a long time ago, and specifically speaking, 1954, with the Supreme Court decision outlawing segregation in the schools, and in 1957, when Martin was thrown that ball in Montgomery, Alabama, when Rosa Parks refused to stand up because her feet hurt. Now, we watched in this 11 years, in this 13 years, depending on the point of view, in this country, a terrible descent
what Rosa Parks was saying in Montgomery in 1956, and what those Negroes were saying when they were marched for 389 days, the country did not want to hear and did not hear. And as time rolled on, and kids, including people like Stokely Carmichael, were being beaten with chains, thrown into jail, marching up and down those dusty highways, trying to change the conscience of this country, still nobody heard, and nobody really cared. And poor Martin spent most of his time in and out of jail, as all of us know, trying to redeem what we claim we live by, the principle of love your neighbor, the principle of if it happens to you, it's happening to me. The principle John Donne talked about, you know, when he said that any man's death diminishes me. But in this country, race and Christianity and power are so tied together in self-interest, what one takes is self-interest, that no one heard it. It's only now that people are beginning to suspect that something terrifying has happened, and with our consent, because we do know that we cannot fight a civil war, which is what this ferment is about, because I am your brother. I was born here. My father's and my father's blood is in this soil, and nothing will drive me from this country. It also belongs to me. You cannot fight a civil war and a global war, too, at the same time, and especially if both are predicated on the same principle. And I'm not now accusing the Americans of being wicked. I'm accusing us of having allowed ourselves to be brainwashed into a state of ignorance which allows us to forget that the peasant in Saigon and the peasant in Detroit are the same people. And what we don't know about the peasant in Saigon is what we don't know about Sambo here. And that has destroyed the American sense of reality. And I suppose what we're here to do tonight is begin to correct that. Any Negro alive in this country, no matter who he is, I mean, from a narcotics addict, from the lowest of the low, even to the most hypocritical of the most hypocritical, knows more about who he is than his white counterpart does. The conditions imposed by the American Republic on the Negro have made it necessary, imperative, that he not fool himself about that. He may be destroyed by it. Is that the same thing? I was born knowing, having to know, by the time I was 5, that life was going to be hard and that I was going to die. White Americans discover this when they're about 30 and then they go to a psychiatrist.
Jail. angels in heaven singing, I love you.
In September 1963, less than a month after the March on Washington, six children died in Birmingham, Alabama. Four little girls were killed in the infamous church bombing there, and two young boys later that day. This event proved to be a turning point in James Baldwin's political activism. From that point on, he became much more vehement in his speech, in his activities, and even in his views. He swayed briefly from nonviolence to considering a new way. As you listen to this next clip, recorded only 10 days after the tragedy in Birmingham, listen to the difference in Baldwin's voice. The anger, the rage, is palpable.
We are not, are we, at the mercy of our political institutions? If we created them, we are responsible for them. We have the right and the duty to overhaul them, to change them. We are not always so helpless that Senator Easton has to stay there forever. Who said so? I dare them to go in any Birmingham barber shop and talk to anybody. I dare them. And I think that commission, the appointment of that commission, the very notion, and the apathy with which the country has greeted it, proves my point. We have no right to allow the death of six children and our common disaster and our common crisis and our moral crisis to be met in this way. It proves, if anything does, that the terms of negotiation must now be radically changed. One cannot negotiate with the representatives of one's oppressor. It is time to let the nation know that the death of my child, I as a black man, and the spiritual death of your child, you as a white man, cannot be met by sending down a commission to find out what happened. We know what happened. What we have to do is prevent it from happening again. And in order to do that, one doesn't beg the Birmingham City Fathers for a truce. You use whatever weight you have to force them to recognize your presence in that city, in that state, and in this country as a man. No matter what it cost, who.
He then lets his anger go for a moment and begins to explain what he believed as the only way life in the United States between blacks and whites could change.
Is that we in this country, black and white, do have in our hands at this moment an enormous and expensive opportunity. If we can think through our situation, if we can face it, we can do something which has not been done in the history of the world before. The terms of our revolution, the American Revolution, the terms are these. Not that I drive you out or that you drive me out, but that we come together and embrace and learn to live together. That is the only way that we can have achieved the American Revolution. Now, if we can face this, and it involves facing a great many things, it demands that white people face the fact that I, for example, or any black person they will ever meet or have ever met, I'm not an exotic rarity, I'm not a stranger, I'm none of those things. On the contrary, for all you know, I might be your uncle, your brother, your cousin, among other things. One of the things that has happened here, and the pathology of the Deep South proves it. So does the pathology of the North, which dictates to them that they move out when I move in. among other things which have to be excavated here, is the fact that this long history is also the history of a love affair. One has got to face this. I'm no longer really black. Maybe I would like to be. Maybe I'd like to go back to Sierra Leone, for example. That was where I came from. But I've been here a long, 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 long time. And I'm now a part of you. And you are a part of me. And the conditions of our maturity, which is our survival, is that we accept this fact and rejoice in it. If we could do that, we might open up and by the example of our own lives and bodies, a possibility that in the future, mankind all over the world will not find it necessary to blow each other up in order to settle a quarrel. Thank you.
I apologize for the quality of the tape at the end there, but please understand this audio was taken from a reel-to-reel tape first recorded on 43 years ago. The Pacifica Radio Archive exists in order to preserve reels like this one. This program, From the Vault, helps the archive to restore reels that are in much worse shape than this one. The beauty of James Baldwin is so complex. His wonderful imagination, his ability to lay down beautiful prose on paper, his oration. Basically, he was a wonderful communicator in all forms. He often spoke to young people at high schools and colleges, and after a speech he gave at Oakland's Castlemont High School in June of 1963, Baldwin was asked a question by one of the students. The student asked Baldwin why did he, quote, write in the fire next time that it is harder for whites to accept blacks than blacks to accept whites.
The reason it's hard is because one has been, and this is not the fault of any white, one white person that one is likely to meet, but the white culture has operated and has operated deliberately to demoralize all black people. And the demoralization has in many cases been fatal, and in all cases has been sinister. The effort, therefore, that I must make to arrive at my identity is mainly in opposition to the white force of the world. Under such a tension, it becomes very difficult. And then, under such a tension, I must repeat, it becomes absolutely necessary to deal with people as people, only as people. Because you cannot spend your life, this is my point, trying to be revenged for historical crimes. If you do that, you will destroy yourself and you will perpetuate the crime. The thing to aim at, this is why it is a terrible necessity to accept white people, but it's a terrible necessity on the part of white people, even harder necessity to accept Negroes, because in order for white people to accept a Negro, they've got to accept their history and something much deeper and worse than that. They got to accept, if I may now be brutal and rude, but I mean this and you must think about it. If you remember that everything that you will do all your life and everything that you will say reveals you, what I call you, doesn't say anything about you, or very rarely, but what I call you says everything about me. Now, there is a very good reason, which has nothing to do with Negroes, why white people call them nigger. It's a white invention. And in order for white people to be released from this invention, they will have to discover where this nigger really lives. And he lives inside white people. And they have to accept him, that stranger within, before they can accept anybody without. That is what I was trying to say.
James Baldwin spent the last 20 years of his life living in Paris, a city he came to know and love when he moved there in 1948. He once said he had to leave the United States again for good in order to, quote, save myself. I loved Medgar, I loved Malcolm, and I loved Martin, and now they are all dead. When you think about it, it is incredible. I'm the last witness. Everybody else is dead. I couldn't stay in America. I had to leave.
All I know about my own life, for example, is that I've been scared to death for 39 years and 6 months. And all I know about fear is that if you're afraid of it, walk toward it.
Sonorous angel, the Norris Jones Road Drone angel, the very deep alone zone angel, ringing, singing, tossing, turning, like the four tops.
In Saint-Paul de Vence, France, on the French Riviera, James Baldwin died of stomach cancer in late 1987. He was 63.
I don't want to see any more blood. Nobody's blood. My God. No, if we could end the nightmare tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, I could die, you know, in peace.
James Baldwin to the rescue again and again.
They came here to make, as we like to say, a better life for themselves and their children. And as it turned out, and as it always does indeed turn out, what they meant by a better life for themselves and their children was the opportunity to make more money and oppress somebody else, which is what they did. The Indians had vanished, except for those we have under protective custody. And in order to build the country, it was necessary to find a source of cheap labor. And therefore, 400 years later, I represent the only man who never wanted to come here.
That does it for another week of From the Vault Remixed. From the Vault is a weekly program produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, and the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. For more information on this program, or to find information on how to purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials of James Baldwin, go online at fromthevaultradio.org or call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Send your comments to comments@fromthevaultradio.org. The music used within this week's show is by R.L. Burnside, 3 Mile Pilot, Ani DeFranco, Zoe Keating, Lead Belly, William Parker's Quartet performing James Baldwin to the Rescue, Jerry Moore performing Ballad of Birmingham. From the Vault, the series, is produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle. Senior producer is Mark Torres. Production coordinator, Edgar Toledo. Outreach by Sean Dulles. Accounting by Mariana Berkovich. And customer service by Arlene Chang. Special thanks to our volunteers, Alan Carmen, TK Munyeka, and Karen Anonia. If you're in the Los Angeles area and would like to volunteer on From the Vault, please go to our website to find out how. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. For more information on him, his music, and other music used within the program, please visit fromthevaultradio.org. This program was executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and myself, Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening.
To come to her face, for when she heard the explosion, her eyes grew wet and wild. She raced through the streets of Birmingham, yelling for her child. She dug in bits of glass and brick, then pulled out a Oh.
This week on From the Vault, we're looking at the political life of James Baldwin. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. I had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Malefi Asante about James Baldwin this past year. Dr. Malefi Asante is considered by his peers to be one of the most distinguished contemporary scholars. He has published 61 books. Among the most recent is Encyclopedia of Black Studies. He has published more scholarly books than any contemporary African author, and has recently been recognized as one of the 10 most widely cited African Americans. In addition, Black Issues in Higher Education recognized him as one of the most influential leaders in the last 15 years.
Baldwin was perhaps our most eloquent essayist. Probably not only that, but at the moment that he lived, particularly in the early 60s, Baldwin was at his height, probably the best writer in America on these issues of race.
Beyond color.
Beyond color.
Black, white.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I grew up on watching him, of course, debate Bill Buckley, watching him with Margaret Mead, and with great respect for him. Of course, he was a creative writer as well, a great novelist, and also a very dynamic playwright, a dramatist. And I saw him, actually, just before his death, a few months before his death in Philadelphia, where I had written the playbill for Amen Corner, and I had dinner with him and about six or seven other people. And he was still, of course, quite angry with this country, and he had a right to be angry with this country. We tried to console him. Certainly, Gwendolyn Brooks, who was there, along with Houston Baker and I, tried to console him. But the thing is that he had just received the Croix de Guerre from the French government, and he had never received any awards from America.
Never received Publishers Awards?
No, or? National Book Award, no American Book Award, no Pulitzer, nothing. And he...
No Glad Media Award.
No, nothing. Right, that's right. No, not at all. That's right. And he was... He felt deeply hurt by that with his career. But one of the things, and this is why I want to get back to the oral tradition, one of the things we said to him that I think sort of comforted him was, and maybe it was Gwendolyn Brooks who led this, Jimmy, you are loved by the people. Your life, your work is in the heart of the people, and the people will continue to tell your story regardless to what other people write. We know who you are. And that, to me, was the essence of the oral tradition, that, in a sense, the fact that I'm sitting here now talking about Jimmy Baldwin, I mean, here is an eloquent voice, a person whose life really, even though it was a life of a literary life, it was also a very verbal life, and I think a very vocal life, a very oral tradition life, and I think this is extremely important, and I think that he was absolutely right on these issues.
In September 1963. Less than a month after the March on Washington, six children died in Birmingham, Alabama. Four little girls were killed in the infamous church bombing there, and two young boys later that day. We now proudly present the speech James Baldwin gave in Harlem, September 25th, 1963, 10 days after the church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama.
We have to talk about economics tonight, and in some detail, we must talk about morals. And I think in some detail, and we must talk about something even more difficult to put one's finger on, which for the moment we will call morale. And the assumption on which I am speaking is this, that whether or not we like it, we have reached a point, black and white in this country, where all of the previous systems of communication, negotiation, accommodation have become unusable. To discuss the economics first. A few days ago, it was suggested by some of us, as forcefully as we knew how, that in order for the country to be unable to ignore and to forget the slaughter of 6 children in an American city, and in order to join the issue and bring the battle to where the battle really is, that is to say, to strike at the economic structure, that no one, black or white, should buy any presents for Christmas. I think that we should spell this out perhaps a little more precisely. I mean, and now I'm speaking for myself, that in this Christian nation, Christmas is mainly, as indeed are most churches, a commercial endeavor, having nothing whatever to do with the birth or the death of Christ. That if one begins to serve notice, ultimately on the banks, that we, the citizens of this country, do not consider that we have the right to celebrate Christmas this year, and that furthermore, we will use every weapon in our power to force this on the attention of the American Republic, which unluckily, I have to say, has its conscience mainly in its pocketbook. I believe that we will begin to see some notion of our potential power. Let me put it this way. Before this country was established, when the country was being established, and this, apart from what one's textbooks say, and in contradistinction to the television myths about the building, the discovery of America, the people who came to America, as it turns out, were neither heroes, saints, nor pilgrims. They were simply people who couldn't make it where they were. And that is why they came. They came here to make, as we like to say, a better life for themselves and their children. And as it turned out, and as it always does indeed turn out, what they meant by a better life for themselves and their children was the opportunity to make more money and oppress somebody else. Which is what they did. The Indians have vanished, except for those we have under protective custody. And in order to build the country, it was necessary to find a source of cheap labor. And therefore, 400 years later, I represent the only man who never wanted to come here. But if I had not come under the double coercion of the Bible and the gun, I very much doubt that we would have all those railroads and cotton would never have become king. And in short, the American economy would be at best a very different matter. Now, if we had the economic weight to line the track and dam the rivers and hoe the cotton and also raise the children, we can now use that weight for the first time for ourselves and for the liberation of this country. It is not true that there is nothing Negroes can do to help themselves, A, and B, it is not true that we, this nation, must be perpetually blackmailed by our government. The government represents us. And finally, C, neither is it true, as so many of the Negroes' friends would have us believe, that the only terms on which we can move to freedom are the terms of Harry Ashmore or Harry Golden. We, the people, are responsible for our own freedom. We are not begging for it. It is up to us to take it. Mr. Livingston said a little earlier something I would like to paraphrase. He said, quoting a friend of his in Birmingham, that the only thing worse than being black in Birmingham is being black and white together. But I would like to paraphrase that a little bit, speaking now of morality, that the only thing worse these days than being a black man in America is being a white man in America. I mean that we are living in a segregated society, which does not mean, as people imagine, that it is simply I who am segregated. It means you are, we all are, and we cannot talk to each other because of the force of social custom and the tyranny of the Southern oligarchy. When I talk about economics, therefore, I am trying to suggest to you, to all of you, that all of you begin to think in very concrete terms. For example, Birmingham is a monstrous city indeed, but Birmingham is not really any worse than New York. There is no place. There is not one square inch of American soil in which a black man can be considered to be free. And if that is so for black men, that is true for all of us. New York is not a segregated city by an act of God or by accident. It is a segregated city partly because a vast number of people and a vast complex of interest make a tremendous profit on the blood of black boys and girls, on the continued imprisonment and the continued demoralization of one-tenth of our population. Now, if it is so that Harlem exists principally for the benefit of people who like money, then it is also possible that one can begin to organize in the ghettos of this nation
a massive civil disobedience campaign. And let me spell out a little bit, I want to be as precise as I can, of what I mean by that. I was born in Harlem. I was raised in Harlem. And indeed, as long as I live, I will never be able really to leave Harlem. As they say, you can take the child out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the child. I know, therefore, what rents one pays for what. I know what you pay for meat, cabbage, clothes, life insurance, theft insurance, fire insurance, and all of this money feeds, ladies and gentlemen, helps to feed the oppressor who uses the money to keep you in jail. Now, isn't it worth considering what one might be able to do if instead of meekly submitting to this species of rape, one decided that instead of paying the rent, one refused to pay the rent. And when it is said that it is illegal to pay the rent, the answer is, it is immoral to charge rent for the houses in which we live. I think that this, for example, among other things, begins to force the economic structure to deal with the problem which will destroy us if we do not deal with it. Because no matter what I may feel, for example, about nonviolence, or no matter how I may feel about how people should treat each other, and no matter how I try to live my life, I'm also aware, and I must be aware, that most people are not really interested, or do not dare perhaps, in any case, do not act toward others as they would like to have others act toward them. And therefore, there is something ultimately futile and terribly dangerous with having so many Negro boys and girls and men and women in the streets so long. I know that this peculiar country has admired the doctrine of nonviolence for 6 or 8 or 9 years. And has applauded all those children and all those ministers and all those men and women who went to jail, who got beaten with chains and with hoses, and who were attacked by dogs, has admired them and has done nothing whatever to help them. And first, and furthermore, not only that, which would be bad enough, intends to keep on admiring them and sending them to jail and doing nothing whatever to help them. Now, I think it is time to blow the whistle. I think it is time to begin to deal with the power structure. We're not dealing with white people. It's not a matter of what white people think about you, or about, you know, what they think about themselves. What one has to do is examine and overhaul the system which creates this and perpetuates it. It is a very important parenthesis, I think, that I probably ought to make. One's got to point out, I think, that in this country, since the McCarthy era, and is one of the reasons for our absolutely, absolutely spectacular impotence, anyone who mentioned the word economics
was promptly given a ticket to Moscow. I think it is beneath me to say that I am not a communist. I think it's beneath the nation, and very dangerous for the nation, to raise this peculiar red herring the moment one begins to deal with things as they are. Now, the nation which admires the doctrine of nonviolence has never in my experience, and never as far as I know in its history, which began, if you remember, in Europe, admired nonviolence before. One of the myths of the English is they would never be slaves. One of the reasons Gary Cooper was such, and Humphrey Bogart were such powerful movie stars, they always had a gun. It's only when a black man says that he might go out and find himself a gun that the country becomes Christian for the first and only time. Now, speaking for myself and trying as best I can to discharge what I take to be my responsibility to everyone in the streets, including me, I don't want to see any more blood. Nobody's blood. My God. No, if we could end the nightmare tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, I could die, you know, in peace. But in fact, the nightmare will not be ended tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And the nation which has admired these boys and girls and men and women overlooks the fact that a boy who was, let us say, 17 in 1955 has now spent 8 years in the streets, is probably under a doctor's care for being beaten half to death by the power structure, ladies and gentlemen, not simply by some idle policeman. Policemen know who they're working for. And by this time, the boy and his wife and his children are very nearly at the end of their rope and are about to crack. This is why it is so important now to try to be precise about what it is that we must do. It is impossible. All my liberal friends and critics to the contrary, it is absolutely impossible for any Negro in this country to be fitted into the structure as it now exists. That is not a possibility. One must be willing to take upon oneself the responsibility of examining and changing the structure so that it becomes more human for everybody. What the Negro's friends pretend, and I'm sorry, baby, but with friends like that, you don't need no enemies, you know. What the Negro's friends pretend is that all the Negro wants is just another Cadillac. He wants to get to be just like Eisenhower. Well, I, speaking for myself, would rather cut my throat than suppose that my forefathers bled and suffered and died for this in this country in order to become yet another blank mediocrity. What we can do, and again, if you remember what I tried to say about economics, and I talked about the landing of the track and what would have happened if we hadn't lined the track, if you think about the myths that American white people have created about American black people, you begin to have some notion of the weight black people have in white people's consciences. It was never true, for example, that I came here wanting to rape nobody, you know. And in fact, I very rarely carried a knife. And I know how to hold my liquor. But the myths to which one is subjected are the most terrifying symptom of the emotional and spiritual and sexual poverty and the panic of the American people.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. The death toll from a simultaneous explosion of hundreds of pagers targeting Hezbollah members in Lebanon is now 12, including two children, with nearly 2,800 injuries. The pagers exploded Tuesday afternoon in public spaces, including grocery stores and city streets. Lebanon's Minister of Health, Dr. Firas Abiad's comments were translated by Al Jazeera. He says about 200 of the victims will need surgery.
Most of these injuries are either injuries to the face, the head, or the waist part of the body. And as reported, many of these injuries also were reported in individuals' eyes that require surgical operation.
CNN and Axios are among the media outlets reporting Israel was behind the attack. No word from Israel, but Tuesday it said it was sending an elite force to the Israeli-Lebanese border and returning residents to their homes nearby is a wartime goal. Israel has killed Hamas militants in the past with booby-trapped cell phones. A Taiwanese company believed to manufacture the pagers says a firm based in Hungary was responsible for that. The attacks raise concerns of a wider regional war. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking during his 10th trip to the Middle East to pursue a ceasefire hostage swap in Gaza, which has spurred the latest escalation of tensions between Israel and Hezbollah.
The United States did not know about, nor was it involved in, these incidents, and we're still gathering the information and gathering the facts. Broadly speaking, we've been very clear, and we remain very clear, about the importance of all parties avoiding any steps that could further escalate the conflict that we're trying to resolve.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The UN General Assembly will vote on a resolution today demanding Israel end its, quote, unlawful presence, unquote, in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. This as the war in Gaza nears a one-year mark. A new report by Save the Children finds five Palestinian children are killed or injured each day in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces or settlers. This since the war in Gaza. Hamas has no control in the West Bank. The children's humanitarian aid group says child deaths in the West Bank have tripled compared to the same preceding time frame. Settlers and forces fatally shot 115 children, up from 39. More than 1,400 have been injured. Condemnation is growing over Republican attacks on an Arab American woman during a congressional hearing on hate crimes Tuesday. Maya Berry, executive director of the Arab American Institute, was a panelist on the Senate Judiciary Committee's hearing. She joined a rabbi and an expert on hate crimes. Republicans singled out Berry, repeatedly questioning her about Hamas and the United Nations Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA, culminating in Louisiana Senator John Kennedy verbally accosting her.
You sir. Support UNRWA and Hamas, don't you?
Sir,
please.
I think it's exceptionally disappointing that you're looking at an Arab American witness before you and saying you support Hamas.
You know what's disappointing to me?
I do not support
you can't
Hamas.
Bring yourself
I do
to
not
say
support Hamas.
You don't
or
support
any...
UNRWA. You don't support Hamas. You don't
I was very clear in my support
Hezbollah
for UNRWA.
Hezbollah, and you don't
I
support
oppose
Iran. You should hide your head in a bag.
After calm, Berry responded.
It's regrettable that I, as I sit here, have experienced the very issue that we're attempting to deal with today. The introduction of foreign policy is not how we keep Arab Americans or Jewish Americans or Muslim Americans or Black people or Asian Americans, anybody safe. This has been regrettably a real disappointment, but very much an indication of the danger to our democratic institutions that we're in now.
CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, blasted Berry's treatment. Robert McGraw with the organization noted it was a hearing on hate crimes and said instead Senator Kennedy and others chose to be an example of the bigotry Arabs, Palestinians, and Muslims have faced in recent months and years. J Street, a Jewish and Israel advocacy group, also continued